Ukraine now on a track toward European Union membership.
On this historic day for Europe, we proceed with this extremely important joint motion for a resolution.
Plus, the U.S. promises more military aid for Ukraine.
Again, the president was very clear with President Zelensky. We're going to help them as much as we can, as fast as we can. And I'll tell you, the material is going in at record speed. I've never seen.
And later in the program, the resilience of Ukrainians who stayed home in the face of Russia's advance. Today is Friday, June 24th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Reddish, substituting for Steve Miller.
Vote is closed, and it is overwhelmingly adopted.
That is Roberta Metsola, President of the European Parliament, with the historic announcement that Ukraine has been granted candidate status to join the European Union. Full membership is still a ways away, but the move sends a signal of solidarity that Europe will not abide by Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine. As well, Ukraine will be getting another $450 million in military aid from the United States. It comes on the eve of two major meetings of world leaders where Ukraine is atop the agenda. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell previews the G7 and NATO summits.
President Joe Biden launches his Europe trip at a summit of G7 leaders in Germany, where they will discuss topics such as global economic challenges, infrastructure, the ticking twin time bombs of climate change and energy security, and the continuing conflict in Ukraine. The White House told VOA that they plan to deliver on several fronts. John Kirby is coordinator for strategic communications at the National Security Council.
We're very much looking forward to a theme of now it's American leadership delivering. Delivering for our allies and partners, delivering for the American people, producing results that will actually improve our national security, help with energy security at home and around the world, and also continue to impose costs and consequences on Mr. Putin for this unprovoked war.
White House officials said the leaders of the seven wealthy democracies will strive to advance a vision of the world grounded in freedom and openness, and also launch a global infrastructure partnership that appears similar to China's Belt and Road Initiative. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to virtually address both summits. Next, Biden heads to Spain for the second NATO summit this year. The 30-member security alliance first tried to avert a Russian invasion of Ukraine. When that failed, they poured weapons and support into Ukraine while placing harsh economic sanctions on Russia. On top of that, NATO watchers say they will try to redefine the purpose of the alliance at this summit. Kathleen McGinnis is a senior fellow and director of the Smart Women, Smart Power Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It's a huge agenda. They're also going to be meeting and endorsing what's called a strategic concept. And it's a nerdy technical term, but what the basic point is it's NATO's statement on what it's going to be doing and prioritizing for the next 10, 15 years.
A pressing issue at this summit is Sweden and Finland's application to join NATO. They face opposition from NATO member Turkey, which objects to those countries' alleged support of a Kurdish extremist movement. Ankara wants the two Nordic nations to bolster their anti-terrorism laws, end a block on arms sales to Turkey, and to extradite certain people, including several Kurdish journalists Turkey alleges are part of the extremist movement. James Jeffrey is a former U.S. ambassador who now heads the Middle East program at the Wilson Center.
I think that it is a mistake to rule out a compromise with President Erdogan. I could spend 5 minutes indicating those just that I've been involved in. I think it's also a mistake to rule out Erdogan at the last minute, upsetting the apple cart and throwing everything into a crisis. I could spend 5 minutes listing that as well. So the jury is out.
This is not the only summit of powerful leaders this month. Leaders of the BRICS bloc of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are meeting virtually this week. And at that meeting, China's president was critical of U.S. aims in Ukraine and in the world. These meetings also raise a deeper question. Nearly 8 decades after the end of World War II, who should run the world? Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
The announcement of another $450 million in U.S. military aid came on the same day that American high-mobility artillery rocket systems arrived in Ukraine. VOA Ukrainian service reporter Yulio Yarmolenko spoke with John Kirby, coordinator for strategic communications at the U.S. National Security Council. She asked for his assessment on the impact these HIMAR weapons systems from the U.S. will have on the fighting that is currently taking place in Ukraine.
The big difference that these HIMARS, which stands for High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, can make is distance, its range. It's giving the Ukrainians the benefit of farther standoff from Russian forces as they continue to fight them every single day, in which is now a much more concentrated geographic area.
And United States providing Ukraine unprecedented level of military assistance. Still people, some voices in Kyiv and in Washington saying it's not enough, it's not fast enough. And do you think, does administration feel like it's providing enough weapons, small and big, to Ukraine to actually make a difference right now on a battlefield?
Well, these systems are making a difference. Even today they're making a difference, and the Ukrainians will tell you that. And it's not just the big systems. It's the small arms and ammunition, which they're using literally every day in this fight with the Russians. So it's already making an impact. And we're obviously the largest donor of security assistance to Ukraine, any other nation in the world, more than $6 billion. Just since almost $7 billion since the beginning of the administration, and almost $6 billion since the beginning of the invasion. So it's a lot of material that's going in, and the president has made clear that we're committed to continuing that assistance going forward.
Okay. And should we expect more HIMARS to be sent to Ukraine, maybe in coming days? And what is the absolute maximum amount that United States can provide HIMARS, MLRS, given its own stocks?
I do think you'll continue to see systems like HIMARS going in future deliveries. I think that that's very likely. I don't want to get ahead of specific announcements here, but again, the president was very clear with President Zelensky. We're going to help them as much as we can, as fast as we can. And I'll tell you, the material is going in at record speed. I've never seen. It's just unprecedented, the speed with which security assistance is actually reaching the front lines in Ukraine. There's literally shipments going in every single day, and it's not just from the United States. We are the biggest donor, but more than 40 other nations around the world are also contributing security assistance in some type or form to Ukraine. Secretary Austin just held the most recent Ukraine contact group in Brussels last week. Almost 50 nations showed up, not just from Europe, but from around the world, to look at ways they can continue to support Ukraine and their ability to defend themselves.
John, can you clarify what administration is providing Ukraine weapons for? To defend themselves or to defeat Russian forces, to push them back outside Ukraine, and ultimately to win this war?
We are really focused on making sure that Ukraine can continue to defend itself and its sovereignty, its people, its territorial integrity. And obviously the Ukrainians are in this fight. They determine what operations they're going to conduct, and that's their right. The material that they get from the United States is now theirs. It's Ukrainian property, and they get to determine how they're going to use it. Now, obviously, we want to see Ukraine's sovereignty fully respected. We want to see Ukraine's territorial integrity fully restored. But how that gets determined, and it should be determined determined by Mr. Putin ending this war, but Mr. Zelensky is going to get to determine what victory looks like.
And if Ukrainians determine that they want to win this war, push Russians back to the February 23rd lines, would you also support that and for them to use the provided weapons to counteroffensive?
Ukrainians are already conducting counteroffensives in their own country. I mean, look at what they've been doing in the south. Look at Kharkiv in the north, where the Russians almost had the city completely encircled. Ukrainians pushed them away, pushed them back towards the border. Mr. Zelensky is the commander in chief of his armed forces. We respect that. He gets to determine how he's going to use those forces and how he's going to define victory. Our job is to make sure that he has the tools available to him to do that in the most efficient, effective way.
This new aid package by the U.S. will not arrive in time to prevent a retreat by Ukrainian forces in the easternmost part of the country, thanks largely to Russia's constant bombardment of the area around Severodonetsk. More from the AP's Charles de Ledesma.
A senior East Ukraine official says after weeks of ferocious fighting, forces will retreat from a besieged city in the country's east. The city of Severodonetsk, the administrative center of the Luhansk region, has faced relentless Russian bombardment, Ukrainian troops fighting the Russians in house-to-house battles before retreating to a huge chemical factory on the city's edge. In recent days, Russian forces have made gains around the city and the neighboring city of Lysychansk in a bid to encircle Ukrainian forces. Now Governor Serhiy Hayday says fighters have been given the orders to leave Severodonetsk to prevent that. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
About 100 kilometers west of Severodonetsk is the city of Kramatorsk. The industrial center had about 210,000 people living there before the war. Two-thirds of that population has fled. Freelance reporter Sam Mednick just left Kramatorsk and told VOA's Carol Van Dam that those who remain think it's too late to leave.
I mean, you see a lot of people who are just living under constant shelling day after day. You see people who, you know, a lot of people have already evacuated. Some people are still trying to leave, but you see a lot of people who don't want to leave. You know, they're just enduring this relentless shelling. I was in the town of Lysychansk, which is one of the hardest hit towns right now, right across from Severodonetsk, which is being encircled by Russian troops at the moment. And there were periods where it was just shelling every few minutes constantly, and you had people, you know, in bunkers, in dark bunkers, just staying there, you know, all day, not leaving. I spoke to the Red Cross, who said they had a team of 18 people living and working in, a bomb shelter, basically going around the town on bicycles because they don't have any cars, trying to deliver food to people. There's one water pump in the city. There's no access to water. So the situation's pretty dire in some of these towns, particularly on the humanitarian front and then of course, on the security front.
You mentioned people just don't want to leave. Does that include perfectly healthy people who are not elderly, who don't have, you know, problems getting around or, you know, a condition? I mean, they just are resolute about staying there?
Yes, I mean, not a lot of the people are elderly or they, you know, have a condition, so it makes it harder for them to leave. But a lot of people, I mean, some people just said, you know, it's too late to leave. Had I wanted to leave, I would have left months ago. Some people, you know, volunteers who had spoken to some people who didn't want to leave said that there's a big fear of the unknown. And a lot of people don't realize that if they do go, they might have access to assistance, that they can get help. So a lot of people are saying, where am I going to go? And, you know, where am I going to live? People say that a lot of the people who left initially, they had more means, more financial means, and they could up and move more easily. And now people are more vulnerable, and for them to leave, it's harder. So a lot of them are just saying, you know what, I'm going to stay here.
Did people have the impression that this was going to be more or less a month or two or three at the most, and now it's going in for the long haul, and they weren't prepared for that?
I think that's definitely something that I've seen, because I was here a few months ago at the start of the invasion in March, and you heard people saying, you know, like everyone, no one really knew what was going to happen, and everyone thought, you know, Kyiv was going to go fairly quickly, and people weren't quite sure. Now you see a shift where people, particularly, I think, also displaced people, even to the west of the country, are saying, okay, this is going to take, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go back home. Like, this is going to be a protracted crisis. You see aid agencies also starting to shift gears and say the same thing. So you're starting to see a shift in this mentality, people saying, you know, this is going to continue. And what does that mean for me? Where do I go? What do I do next?
And militarily, have there been a shift in tactics, too, as far as not just the civilians, but the soldiers? Do you see what's going on strategically at all?
I mean, what the soldiers have told me, what analysts say is that it's become, you know, it's shifted into a war of an artillery battle. So you're just seeing both sides shoot artillery back and forth, whereas at the beginning you had more ground troops, you had more urban combat, and now it's just, you know, shooting back and forth, turning into a war of attrition, trying to wear the other side down. Russia is trying to take the east and the Donbass, and I think also towards the south. But it's unclear if they'll be able to do that, but they're closing in on Luhansk right now. And if they do that, then their next, you know, goal would be Donetsk.
And if that happens, would it be that the Ukrainians would not have access anymore to the Black Sea ports?
If they take Odessa, if they take the city of Odessa, they won't have access to the Black Sea ports. At the moment, that does not look imminent. However, if they do, you know, push towards Odessa and take that and take Mykolaiv, the town near Odessa, and then take Odessa, which is the larger town, they'll have complete control of the Black Sea ports.
That was freelance reporter Sam Mednick, who was in Lviv, Ukraine. listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Reddish. As anchor of the popular VOA TV news program Chaz Time, Miroslava Gongadze has become a household name in Ukraine. Now, as chief of our Eastern European Bureau, Miroslava just got back from a week-long reporting mission for VOA in Ukraine. I spoke to her just after she crossed back into Poland to find out what she saw, heard, and discovered about her homeland and its people.
I didn't know what to expect, but from the outside, you see the war on TV. It feels totally different. In Kyiv, it's pretty safe right now. It's pretty calm right now. People are sitting in the cafes, drinking wine, having coffee. The stores are full of food, and you feel like kind of maybe false sense of security. But that's in the capital or in the west of the country. But when you go outside of the of capital, I went to Chernihiv region. It's like 45 miles from a Belarusian border. Or I went outside of Kyiv in town called Moshchun, and devastation is right in front of your eyes. In Moshchun, the town is almost totally burned down, and the only way the people were able to escape the same horror as people faced in Bucha or Irpin, because people were organized themselves and were able to leave the country, to leave the town before Russian forces arrived. So, but when they went back, they found their houses totally burned down by rockets and by fire. And right now, they try to assess the damage. They try to understand what next for them, because they lost all their livelihoods. And what struck me that some of them say they don't look back. They are looking forward, and they would rebuild the houses that they lost. Like 70 years old man told me, I'm already making plans to rebuild my house that he built himself in last 15 years. The lady, 60-year-old lady, who lost her father, she lost her son, and she lost her whole household in the last 3 months. And she came to us, she cried, she told the story, but then she went back and she brought us box of beautiful strawberries from her garden and said, "This is for you, please enjoy yourself." And this resilience of people is just stuck me it's unbelievable. One lady came to me from the totally burned down house, and she said, "I have this very famous Ukrainian poetry book, a Taras Shevchenko book, Kobzar, and from 1931. And she said, "This is the only book survived from my library, and I wanted to give it to you, because I'm following you for years. I'm a teacher. I wanted I want you to have this book." And I was literally crying, because it's just incredible how open in this sadness and horror, people are still looking forward and trying to find happiness and be thankful for specifically for U.S. support, for Western U.S. support. Everyone I met, they said, "Thank you so much for helping us. Thank you so much."
What can you tell me about how they view the West coming to their help?
They are thankful. At this point, they say, "Thank you for anything you can do or everything you can do. We realize that we are on our own. But you have to understand," they tell me, "you have to understand that we are not defending just our country. We are not defending our families, our safety. We are defending the world as well. We are defending democracy." And it's on every level, on a political level or on a regular people level. They said, "We are fighting not just for us." And they do expect more, obviously, because the anxiety is there. The situation is really, really difficult. I had conversations with the commander of chief of Ukrainian army. I had conversations with the head of National Security Council. I had a conversation with soldiers. They all tell me that they understand that this, that without the Western support, without the a strategic, permanent, sustainable Western support, they would not be able to hold the front line. And we are on the West have to understand that as well. They said, we are ready to fight. We are ready to do whatever. Just help us with the military support and we will do the job. Just give us weapons.
Can you tell us how the food, water, all of the supplies that people need on an everyday basis just to live, how are people adjusting and getting the daily necessities so that they can carry on?
Honestly, in the part of the country that I visited, even those that Chernihiv town was bombarded a lot as well, or the couple of towns that are outside of Kyiv, in those places, the communities organize themselves very well, and I have not seen shortage of food or supplies. They have everything they need and around the country. But the east of the country is much more difficult. And when I was there, the Kharkiv area was bombarded. The area that occupied by Russians, we don't even know what's going on there. We can only assume the horror people are going through. The people who survived the occupation and now are free, they showed me how they survived. They had were running around, hiding from rockets, getting water. One man told me that he held 27 people in his house because he had generator and were able to get fresh water. And they ate supplies that they had in their basements. And Ukrainian people, but in the same time, they already they're harvesting food right now at this point. So it's just Ukrainians are very resilient. They know what a shortage of food means. So they are always prepared to have no food and survive for at least months or two. So there's not much shortage of food in the area I went, but I know that in the area in the east, there is a problem.
Expect to hear more from Miroslava next week about her trip to Ukraine. That's going to do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Reddish. Good night.
America, Washington, D.C.